business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii? Draw nine. Give the attention and you shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-15-48PO versus JS. Arguing for petitioner, Stephen L. Hartley. Also appearing for petitioner, Elsa F. M. McGeehee and Elena L. Bryant. Arguing for respondent, Courtney N. Nasso. Also appearing for respondent, Kendra S. Rivers. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Hartley and Ms. Nasso. Are you both ready to proceed today? All right. And the court will just remind counsel that in view of the confidential nature of the underlying proceeding, they should refer to the parties here as mother, father, and child. Does everyone understand that? All right. And we're here for a 40-minute oral argument today. So, Mr. Hartley, you'll be reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal, and Ms. Nasso will give you a 5-minute warning. So 20 minutes per side. Please proceed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, Stephen Hartley, as previously represented on behalf of the appellant petitioner in the writ of certiorari to which we're here on this morning. We're here, Your Honors, for two primary issues before this court. The first issue is whether or not the denial of the father's right to have his child support obligation reviewed and recalculated was proper and appropriate under the facts and circumstances of this case, and whether or not the Intermediate Court of Appeals erred in confirming the family court's denial of that modification. The second issue that we're here on this morning is whether or not the family court erred in refusing or in not completely considering the equities of the case in making the determination that the father had a child support arrearage starting from February 2011 to the date of trial in the amount of almost $65,000. It's our contention, Your Honors, that the family court did err on both counts for the following reasons. First, with regard to the first argument, the first point, it's our contention that the family court did err in denying father's right to have his child support order modified, at least reviewed. First, because as this court knows, under Hawaii Revised Statutes 576D and 576E, the enabling and enacting child support statutes, pursuant to those statutes, the family court must use the Hawaii child support guidelines in calculating child support in any matters before the family court. That is, any family law related matters included paternity cases like the one at issue this morning. In this case, it is beyond contention, it is uncontroverted, that the family court never used a child support guideline worksheet, never filed, not one. What happened, for very brief background, was the child at issue was born in October of 2007. In 2008, a year after the child was born, the parties filed their paternity case. In connection with that initial paternity case, there was one order filed with the family court setting child support at $4,500 per month. But again, there was no child support guidelines worksheet. That amount was arbitrarily agreed to between the parties.
Sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Yes. Hartley, but could you help me with the issue of the obligation of the family court to consider the family court guidelines where there's an agreement or a stipulation between the parties as to child support? To what extent, if at all, would the court have an obligation to independently review that and interfere with? You might use that term, interfere with an agreement between the parties to come to a resolution of something as contentious as child support.
Well, that's a very good question, Justice Wilson, and my answer is it's our contention that the family court does not have a choice to a degree. In other words, pursuant to the statutes that I've just cited, the HRS 576 D and E, it is very clearly written that it's a shall. The family court shall use the child support guidelines in computing child support.
Well, in addition, from a practical point of view, then, is it your view that every stipulated agreement that pertains to child support must be independently reviewed by the court, and the review must be done in light of the guidelines?
Yes, that is our position, and I can go one further, Justice Wilson, in saying this, that in divorce cases in family law today, the child support guidelines are required even when the parties reach an agreement otherwise. And here's the reason. As the court knows, cited in CSCA versus AP, it was an Intermediate Court of Appeals decision, summary disposition order in 2013. They affirmed and they recited the same principle of law that the guidelines have to be used in determining child support. They also noted that case law has found that the court has discretion to order what are called exceptional circumstances. And one of the exceptional circumstances already recognized by the Hawaii Family Courts is when a payor, an obligor, agrees to pay more than calculated under the guidelines. The courts approve that as an exceptional circumstance.
So that would automatically, in your view, constitute an exceptional circumstance when there's an agreement for the payor to pay more than would be calculated under the family court guidelines.
Yeah, my understanding of the law, Justice Wilson, is that is what the law presumes.
Well, the law says there's actually a statutory exception that says except when exceptional circumstances warrant departure. So what is, when you say your understanding of what the law requires, this is based on case law?
Yes, based on case law, Chief Justice. Based on the case law, including the case I just cited, CSCA versus AP. And other case law, the previous and following case law, confirming that one of the recognized to date exceptional circumstances is when a payor, an obligor, agrees voluntarily to pay more.
But it only goes one way. They can't agree to pay less?
Absolutely, Chief Justice. It cannot go the other way according to case law. So you can agree to pay more, and that is an exceptional circumstance. But the problem in this case, Your Honors, is we never even had a baseline calculation of child support to determine how much more the father in this case had agreed to pay. All we have are arbitrary amounts agreed to at the time between the parties. And we're not suggesting that.
Excuse me, why wouldn't that be an exercise in frustration? You know, our family court is really packed with a heavy caseload. And you have two parties who are coming there who have agreed to pay $3,500 a month. But you say that the court should still hold a hearing and go through the different guidelines. And then apply the exceptional circumstance. Well, why do you need to take those steps if you've already got an agreement?
Yeah, and what I'm suggesting, Justice Nakayama, is not that you have to have a full hearing, but what I'm suggesting is there should be, again, and I'm just using it as a comparison, as done in divorce cases in family court, the requirement of the party submitting the child support guidelines worksheet, which, by the way, has an exceptional circumstance page as part of the calculation that is required to be submitted when the parties are asking the court to affirm an exceptional circumstance. Because again, under case law, not statutory provision, it's the family court judge who has the final say in whether to deem an agreement by the parties to be an exceptional circumstance. Again, but in this case, we never even had not one child support guideline worksheet filed in this case. The parties agreed to these various amounts over the course of the case. And on August 19th, 2013, the father filed his motion for relief. That's what started the instant case.
Mr. Harvey, I understand that this is an adversarial process, and especially in this particular instance. However, it's up to the attorney's counsel to assist the judge in coming to a fair and equitable decision regarding child support. How helpful is it to a trial judge when you suggest $70 a month as the correct amount to pay for a child's support?
Well, in answer to your question, Justice Nakayama, I would say if that is what is borne out by application of the law and this child support guidelines worksheet and instructions at the time, then I think it's the most helpful we trial attorneys can be.
You previously appealed a case when the court ordered $50 a month, right?
In connection with this case?
No, in a different case. Anyway, it's not part of the record.
Okay, no, and I apologize, Justice Duncan. I don't recall what case that was. In connection with this case?
No, it was a different case. But you had appealed when the court ordered $50 a month child support.
Okay, but in answer to your question here, the submission of the $70 child support calculation was, again, directly pursuant to the guidelines worksheet at the time, and that, as the court knows, is the amount set by the state legislature through the guidelines and through the statutory provisions as the minimal child support. In other words, when there is not enough income earned by either party, the payor or the recipient, the child support calculation cannot ever be less than $70 a month.
Can a person who is responsible for child support and has a lot of money give the money away and so that person won't have to pay child support? Can they and get it down to $70? I have this big, and I just don't want to pay. I hate the child. I hate the mother. I'm going to just give my money away.
I would say no, and it would be incumbent on, at that point, the recipient, who could, at this point could be the father as well as the mother, it would be incumbent upon them to bring a proper action before the family court to enforce the child support obligation. That's not what we have in this
How
case.
Is it different from spending $200,000 on a wedding?
Okay. In this case, we don't have a situation where the father chose not to pay his obligation. That's the distinguishing factor that I would submit to the court.
Didn't he, by choosing to spend the money on his wedding, didn't he make an election between having a lavish wedding and supporting his child?
No, because at that point in time, according to the record, as argued at the trial court, the parties had agreed to their most recent changed child support. At that time...
Which change was that?
It was down to $1,500.
I thought there was a dispute as to whether or not there was such an agreement, and the family court found your client not credible on that issue.
Correct, Justice Nakayama. Justice McKenna, what I'm saying is, in December of 2012, and I'm tying it up with Justice Nakayama's question about the wedding, at that time, in December of 2012, according to the father, the parties had reached an agreement to lower child support again to $1,500. He continued to pay that, is my point that I'm trying to make. He didn't stop paying child support. He paid that amount each and every month for almost a year, for 11 months, and that continued all the way through to the filing of his motion for relief in the instant case. So never once did he stop paying. So in answer to the question about him using his saved up assets that he had earned in his career as a National Football League player, he did make that election. And that's a judgment call. It would be my answer to the court. I can't make that personal judgment. I'm trying to take the facts as I have them, of course, advocating for the father in this case.
Aren't we sort of getting a step ahead? I understand the questions that are being asked, but it seems to me that one of the concerns as we look at this is the guidelines were never applied, so we don't know what the amount was. We don't know if the family court judge said, wait a minute, you've got resources that you're not bringing forth. Wait a second, you just got a college degree, even though say you can't work right now, I can look at your earning potential. The concern in this case is the court, by not using the family court guidelines, it's put us in a situation where the court just continued on with a $3,500 amount without us being given a really realistic means to review that award.
Well, and I would agree with you completely, Justice Pollack.
And in fact, that $3,500 may be exactly right. But we just don't, as I look at it, we don't know what's underlying it.
And I would agree with you, Justice Pollack, entirely, because that is the argument that was made at trial on behalf of father. At that time, we asked the primary issue separate from the custody-related issues. The primary issue on child support was a request by father to, at the time of the filing of the motion for relief, August 2013, to do a recalculation and review at that time, using the evidence submitted during trial, which, by the way, there was significant testimony and evidence accepted during trial regarding both parties' incomes. And so the dispute as to whether or not father rightfully should have a $70 minimal child support obligation, or whether he should be imputed a lot of money, never got heard. It was argued, but then when the order came out, the order just went back in time and didn't say further about any of those issues.
What about the question of whether of a change in material circumstances? There seemed to family court seemed to think that there was a requirement to show that, the ICA, and it had not been shown. The ICA affirmed on that grounds. What's your take on that issue?
Yeah, with regard to that, Chief Justice, that was not argued below at the trial level because it was an assumption made that the modification or at least a review was going to be had. But in retrospect, following the court's order, and that was the first time the family court in its order mentioned the Davis v. Davis case and said, we're not even going to consider a modification as requested by father at this time because he has failed to meet his burden showing a material change in circumstances. What we would submit and contend is that's in error as well by as a matter of law because, as the court knows, the same enabling and enacting statutes I've already cited provide very clearly that every 3 years, any obligor of child support has the right to request a review. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to change. In fact, sometimes it goes up. But any obligor has the right to request a review every 3 years without any showing of material change in circumstance. So requiring the material change in circumstance, it's our contention that that was an error as well. But nonetheless, even if required under Davis v. Davis, our contention would be the sufficient facts were presented to establish a material change in circumstances between February 2011, which was the agreed upon date that the parties amended their child support on their own to $3,500, and the filing date of the father's motion to modify child support. So during that period of time, which is the analysis time, it's our contention that a material change in circumstance was presented to the court, and that information was certainly available to the trial court.
Very well.
Thank you.
Do you reserve your time for rebuttal?
Thank you.
All right. All right, at this point, we'll hear from Ms. Nasso. Thank you, Ms. Nasso.
Morning. May it please the court, Chief Justice Reckonwald.
Good morning.
Please the court, justices. Courtney Nasso on behalf of respondent in this matter. The court is already aware of the two questions being presented on cert this morning.
Well, could you move the mic in? I'm sorry, you need to.
Thank you
very much.
Can you please refrain from using the parties' names?
Absolutely. Did I use their names? I'm sorry. I did to introduce myself, sorry. I apologize. The court is already aware of the two questions presented before it today, so I'm not going to repeat them. However, at this time, respondent respectfully submits that this court should affirm the ICA, which found that the family court's findings of facts and conclusions of law were proper and based on the evidence that were before it at the time of trial. Prior to getting into the substance of our argument today, I'd like to point out as a procedural issue, there really is no basis for the Supreme Court this morning to overturn the trial court's findings of facts and conclusions of law. Petitioner has not appealed or challenged them in any way in his points of error pursuant to Hawaii Rules Appellate Procedure 28B4. Therefore, for purpose of this appeal, the findings and facts and conclusions of law are deemed binding and petitioner's objections are deemed waived. However, if the Supreme Court opts to find that his objections are not deemed waived, then we move forward. Davis set forth a three-prong test or three questions that the family court must ask itself and answer.
Wasn't Davis decided 15 years before the statute changed?
I don't know exactly 15 years, but yes, Your Honor, it was quite a while ago. However, I think it still remains. The three questions are relevant. Was there a material change of circumstances? Should there be a modification? And what it should be?
Well, except it requires a material change in circumstances, and the current statutes say once every 3 years, you don't have to show a material change in circumstances. In fact, the statute says that if you ask a second time in 3 years, then you do have to show it. So it seems quite clear that Davis's ruling has been superseded by our law.
I think I would distinguish that, Justice Pollack, in that the statute says that once every 3 years, somebody can seek a review, as you correctly stated, without showing a material change of circumstances. However, we don't have that in this case. There was not the passage of 3 years of time. So we're still left with, was there a material change of circumstances?
When was the last court order?
The last court order was October of 2013.
Wait. The last order before the motion was made?
Prior to the motion, Your Honor, it was July 21, 2010.
So that would be more than 3 years, assuming your reading is correct, because it says, it doesn't necessarily say you have to wait 3 years. The statute says once every 3 years.
That's correct, Justice. So even if somebody is petitioning within that three-year time that they are allowed to seek a review, as counsel stated correctly, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get a reduction. In fact, you are at risk of getting sometimes no change or an increase in your child support.
Let's get back to the three-year issue. I'm a little confused by your argument on the 3 years. The last order was July of 2010, and the petition was filed in August of 2013.
Your Honor, I was going based off of the party's trial and the trial court's decision, and the last order prior to trial was dated October 7th.
That was the temporary order after the request to modify child support.
I understand, Your Honor.
And the trial took a while, obviously.
But, yes, I understand, Your Honor. So I misspoke. I clarified. It was July 21, 2010, prior to petitioner filing his August 2013 motion to reduce child support.
Right. So the 3 years has passed. That's proper under 57060.
Yes, Your Honor. However, we still have to be considerate of the statute that says child support guidelines would be used except when exceptional circumstances warrant.
But aren't the guidelines really clear that you need to do the worksheet and then the court determines whether or not there shall be a deviation based on exceptional circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe that they should be doing a child support guideline worksheet. However, in this case, we have three times that these parties in the course of this case made agreements between themselves.
Right. So at the point in time that there was this petition in August of 2013 to modify child support, at that time, wasn't the court then, there was no agreement anymore. I understand the arguments with respect to agreements. You know, it does seem a little bit unfair when represented parties submit an agreement which the court approves, and then one of the parties comes back and says, oh, no, I didn't really owe that even though I agreed to it, so therefore pay me back for what I paid. That seems grossly unfair. But once the party says, listen, this is not right, I need a modification, when there's no longer an agreement, isn't it pretty clear that the law requires the court to do the child support calculation, the guideline calculation, and then determine whether or not an exceptional circumstance applies?
Your Honor, I do see your point. However, I think this trial court went even beyond that and was considering the fact that here we are dealing with a college graduate who is not working.
My question is, isn't that what the law requires?
To run the guidelines?
To do a worksheet and then determine whether there should be a deviation based on exceptional circumstances. That's how I read the guidelines, the 2010 guidelines.
Yes, I would submit, as I stated previously, that is correct. However, that was not done in this case. I don't know why it wasn't done in this case.
Well, while you're on that, Ms. Nasser, I'm sorry to interrupt, but could you complete the thought that I think you were working on, that let's assume that it wasn't necessary to show material change in circumstances. There was a requirement to just purely apply the guidelines. You're suggesting, I think, that if the guidelines were applied from the point of view this is just a modification within the 3 years, then the court would have come up with the same result. Is that your view? And if that's your view, how do you analyze that, given the fact that $200,000 had been spent on a wedding and that he decided to pay the debts for his father? I mean, how do you analyze the facts and come to the conclusion that the court's decision would have been the same?
Yes, Justice Wilson, I would analyze it that the trial court would have come to exactly the same decision for multiple reasons. We're dealing with the petitioner who was a college graduate as of 2013, was not working, had stated on the record he had no intention of working, was not looking for a job, had indicated on the record that he was disabled or there was a medical disability, yet there was no proof of that provided to the court. Yes.
Assuming what you're saying is true, what about Justice Pollack's proposal that It maybe will come out exactly the same, but isn't the court at any rate still obligated to apply the guidelines, even if it does come out the same?
Yes, and I think I've been quite clear in submitting that, yes, guidelines should be done, and unfortunately, we don't have the benefit, as Justice Pollack recognized, we don't have the benefit of that in this case, but to answer Justice Wilson's question, I think the court would still get to the same thing.
How do we know that? How do we know? I mean, you have good arguments, but we don't know until the court actually runs the numbers and exercises discretion. Isn't that true? Or how can we be confident of the outcome you're suggesting as opposed to remanding for the family court to do that in the first instance?
Yes, Chief Justice. The only way that I'm confident in responding to your question is just based on the analysis that our family court did in this case. And to also get back to what Justice Wilson was curious about, the trial court found that this petitioner had substantial assets. Yes, he had, in fact, spent $200,000 on a wedding, a very lavish wedding. But what also came out in the record is he had two Merrill Lynch accounts where he had transferred substantial assets in the amount of over $467,000 that were unaccounted for in trial. So the family court was well within its discretion to find that he still had money and resources available to pay his child support, but up to that point had decided to make as a priority to pay for a lavish wedding and other debts. And with as regard to the cancer treatment, he testified he was paying for his father's cancer treatment, yet there was nothing in the record to prove that that actually happened or what amount, if anything, was paid toward that end. So the family court is entitled to conclude that he still had resources available. He was not working. He had assets available. The $3,500 per month was merely a continuation of what he had agreed to with all the same circumstances existing at the time of agreement. He was already released from the NFL and not working and using his assets to pay for child support. Furthermore, when he asks to reduce his child support to $70 a month, that was simply unreasonable. He didn't provide the family court with any credible evidence of what his income
you know,
is.
Your argument is very interesting, and maybe it would have supported a lot more than $3,500. And that's the problem. Because $3,500 might be correct, and if there's hundreds of thousands in that bank account, maybe you should be back up to what it was initially. I think it started at $8,500 or something from the beginning. So, you know, it all has to be evaluated, including I think mother had just gotten a job too. It all needs to be calculated and evaluated.
So, Justice Pollack, I believe the family court did evaluate that. Mother did testify about the income that she had. And to just clarify, it's not that she just had gotten a job. Actually, mother was working when she gave birth. She stopped working by the party's agreement that he did not want her to work until the child entered kindergarten so she could be the sole caregiver for the child. So that was by party's agreement. That would have taken them to August 2013. Mother did begin working. And in the record, as of her September 18, 2013 motion, there was a paternity financial information sheet attached which indicated that she had income of $2,888. And at trial, I believe, it was updated where she had income of $2,343, yet through testimony had just gotten her real estate license and was expecting an influx of income. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that she had stipulated that her income was about $3,500 a month. So the court did consider, based on mom's credible reporting of her income, but father did not provide any credible evidence of his income. And so under Cleveland, the court can consider two things. What is he capable of earning as the payor, and what is the size of his estate or his net worth? And that's exactly what happened in this case.
Well, while you're explaining that calculation, I wanted to ask for a clarification from you, Ms. Nasso, about what the judge found in terms of whether there was a material change of circumstances. Are you saying that when the guidelines were applied, the result was a $3,500 payment, or are you saying that when the guidelines were applied, there was a reason to depart from the guidelines because there was a material change of circumstances?
Justice Wilson, I don't believe the guidelines were applied, and I think that's why I've gotten several questions about shouldn't they have been applied. And I have submitted that, yes, the guidelines should have been applied, but they weren't in this case because the family court...
But you were supplying us with an analysis about what would have happened if they were applied and suggesting that the determination of the trial court, the family court, was reasonable. And from that point of view, I just wanted to be clear. Are you saying that if the guidelines had been applied, there wouldn't have been necessary for the court to find that there had been a change, a material change of circumstances? Or are you saying that the evidence that you're reciting shows that there was a material change in circumstances that would justify, the, in this case, the father paying more than the guidelines?
I believe, Justice Wilson, that if the guidelines were applied, the family court would have determined that there still was no material change of circumstances from the party's agreement in February of 2011, which said the child support was going to be $3,500 per month. Added on to that analysis, the court would have found that there are exceptional circumstances. Modification was not warranted because all those same circumstances existed at the time, and in consideration of all the other facts in this case, which Cleveland also says, you have to look at each case on a case-by-case basis, looking at the circumstances of that particular case. And here we have assets that were available to the petitioner. We have his ability to work, but him choosing not to work. No.
But how can we tell that the court's assessment of those factors was reasonable without the baseline of the... of applying the child support guidelines? How do we know? I mean, you're arguing a lot of reasons why it was reasonable, but how, without knowing what that baseline was, how can we meaningfully exercise appellate review here?
I think one way to look at it is the baseline was what the parties had agreed to. At the same time where he was already released from the NFL and not working, that is the baseline, arguably. Secondly, the family court has the discretion to make these decisions, and unless there is shown that there has been a manifest abuse of that discretion, which has not been shown in this case, the family court is well within its discretion to look at all of these factors and all these reasons that I've been arguing and make a determination of
what. Isn't that Mr. Hartley's argument, that he can't do that without the record reflecting how the guidelines would have been applied? He said he asked for it, didn't get it. Now he can't meaningfully argue that the amount that was settled on by the trial court, pardon me, the family court, was an abuse of discretion, or it's difficult to do so.
It would have been very difficult, Chief Justice, to run guidelines when we didn't even have what petitioner's actual earnings were. And we don't have actual earnings because he was not working and choosing not to work, even though he was able to work, and there's nothing in the record showing otherwise.
So as a practical matter, if there's no evidence of father's income, it's pretty clear that if the guidelines had been run, it would have come out $70 a month as an unemployed person. The initial calculation would have been $70. If the court had run through, put the mother's income and the father's income of zero, it would have come out $70, right, initially.
I haven't run the guidelines, but I would submit that you are probably correct, Justice McKenna.
Isn't that under the 2010 guidelines, $70 was the minimum unemployed person,
yes,
right?
Sir.
So therefore, the record, based on the facts, it would have been 70. If the worksheet would have shown $70.
I submit
the court knew that the worksheet would have shown $70, basically, but she didn't say that.
That's correct.
In her findings.
That's correct.
But we could actually take judicial notice of the fact that it would have come out $70. It's very clear that when you have an unemployed person under the 2010 guidelines, for one child, it's $70.
And that's why, as a matter of public policy, are we going to obligate our family court to modify child support to a bare minimum when we're having a refusal?
And therefore, the court found an exceptional circumstance.
Exactly, Your Honor.
But what about all the other things the court was supposed to find? What about earning potential? You yourself just said that college graduate, he said that even the new spouse testified that he was going to go back to work. So the problem still remains that there were many numbers that weren't determined.
Yes, I would agree with you, Justice Pollack. However, how can the family court determine petitioner's earning potential when he's not providing any of that credible evidence because he's purposely choosing not to work when he's capable of working?
Is anybody who doesn't work, you can't determine earning potential?
I don't think that's the family court's role if no evidence is being put before the trial court of what his earning potential would be. And to
the family court often, not often, but sometimes gets parents who intentionally quit a high-paying job because they don't want to pay child support.
Exactly.
And the court will impute that as earning potential.
Right. If the person is unemployed or underemployed, which I believe is how the family court arrived at its findings of facts in this case, is that we have a petitioner coming to the trial court who is unemployed and underemployed. We don't know his exact earning potential because he's choosing not to work. However, the court has the discretion to say, you've agreed to $3,500 in the past. That shows your earning potential. That shows your ability to pay that because you were paying that when you were already released from the NFL, you weren't working, and you didn't have an income, and that was your ability to pay.
Did the family court make any findings about this $400,000-something that apparently had been placed in some sort of retirement account?
I think, Your Honor, Justice McKenna, the family court made the finding that
I know
petitioner had assets and resources available to him based on the testimony and the exhibits M7 and M8, that M7 was received into evidence and M8 offered for identification. Okay. Based on all the testimony of the amounts of securities and cash that were being transferred out by petitioner, the family court did make the finding of fact that he did still have substantial resources available to him to pay his child support, which is permitted by the guidelines as well.
Ms. Nasso, in light of the mandatory language of 576D, that the court shall use the guidelines, how can you argue against remand?
Yes, thank you, Justice Nakayama. There are two things. We also have 584-15E, which says you should calculate based on the child support guideline. But in this case, the ICA even referred to HRS 571-52.5, which says use the guidelines except when exceptional circumstances warrant a departure.
It doesn't say don't use the guidelines. What it says is the court shall use them except when exceptional circumstances warrant departure. In other words, you utilize the guidelines, but based on that amount, which is presumptive, the appropriate amount according to our cases, then you can depart. And there very well may have been a justification for departure, but we don't know what the baseline or that amount would have been.
Yes, you are correct, Justice Pollack, and I did acknowledge that 571-52.5 said to use the guidelines unless there was exceptional circumstances. I want to clarify that in case it didn't come clear. But the baseline we are arguing in this case is what petitioner agreed to when he already was not working and he already had no income and he already testified that he was using his assets and resources to pay his child support.
Doesn't the statute require that the court apply exceptional circumstances to deviate from the guidelines, right? So how would you know how much you could deviate from the guidelines to apply exceptional circumstances if you don't know what the guidelines say in the first place?
Well, as Justice McKenna had pointed out, the family court judge probably had a pretty good idea of what the guidelines would have been, even though they were not run. But in this case, the judge, through multiple findings of facts, was able to identify many exceptional circumstances. I see that my red light is on.
Yeah, if you would, you can answer the question and then briefly wrap up, and we'll need to hear from Mr. Hartley and conclude for our
Thank you, Chief Justice. So I hope that answers your question, Justice Nakayama, that the court did go ahead and make an analysis, a multifaceted analysis of all the exceptional circumstances using the baseline that he had agreed to when he already was not employed and had no income but was using his resources to pay for child support. So toward that end, thank you for your time this morning, and Respondent is respectfully submitting that the Supreme Court affirm the ICA decision, which was affirming the family court findings of facts and conclusions of law that were based on proper evidence.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hartley, your rebuttal.
Very briefly, I wanted to comment on a couple of the points that were just made by Ms. Nasso, and I want to, with all due respect, remind this court that Ms. Nasso is doing yeoman's work this morning because she was not the trial attorney in this case, in fact, was not involved. And so she had to review the record in advance of this oral argument this morning. I state that because I don't hold it against her one bit that she has misstated the record in a couple of significant ways. She was asked a question about whether or not income was imputed to the father in this case. In fact, the answer is yes. As part of our final written argument, the evidence submitted to the trial court, the petitioner's, the father's attorney, me, submitted a child support guideline worksheet with imputed income to him based on an averaged amount that a college earning man in his degree, now, granted, not in the NFL, he was retired from the NFL 3 years hence, but we calculated it based upon his degree in African American studies. What does that mean? We did the best we could, as we always do, plugging in an imputed amount. Nonetheless, with that imputed amount and the income that was provided by the respondent mother in this case at the trial court level, we plugged that in, and it was that calculation that came to still the minimal 70. As Justice McKenna noted and knows from past experience, that it's not just a situation where an obligor has zero income, that the guidelines result in a $70 calculation. In fact, both parties can have income and it can still result in the minimal amount of child support.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Hartley, but wouldn't that suggest that perhaps in part because of your diligence in submitting a workout of the guidelines, that the analysis in this case, that I think essentially is what the ICA was suggesting, is that the court did actually consider the circumstances, including the $200,000 that had been spent and including the payment of the decision to make payments for the father, and in that regard decided that there was a material change of circumstances. I mean, the court had before it your application of the guidelines, and as Justice McKenna has suggested, that probably wouldn't be that difficult, especially with an unemployed person, to have an idea what the guidelines would suggest. And considering that there was an agreement entered into between the parties after your client had been unemployed, that the court could at least look at that as a reference and say, well, at least at that point, even though unemployed, the father felt that he could pay $3,500 a month. And then I guess I'm extrapolating to the point of saying that maybe the record actually does reflect that the court considered the guidelines and did actually find, although I think that the position that was taken by Ms. Nasso was that the court didn't find material change in circumstances, but
yeah, and
perhaps
that
suggestion is.
The problem with this case at this time is that the court, again, we come back to the fundamental issue that I opened with, is that the court never did a calculation of child support pursuant to the guidelines. So all of these other arguments about change of circumstances, and by the way, I think we're confusing the requirement under Davis v. Davis for change of circumstances. That requirement, the material change in circumstances, is a step one procedure pursuant to case law that says if you don't otherwise have the right to request a modification of child support, if you don't otherwise, in this case we did, it was the 3-year automatic review.
Well, I mean, I'm applying the standard under 576D7 that I think you're alluding to, which is the standard that would be applied in the event that there was a modification and there was no burden on the part of the father at that time other than to show that the guidelines either suggested what it did or to refute the idea, which was available, I think, to the mother, the idea that there was a material change in circumstances that would allow for departure from the guidelines.
Well, I would submit, Justice Wilson, that I wish we could answer those questions. I wish I could answer you right now. But again, the one and only reason I cannot answer those questions and was not able to brief those issues previously before coming before this court is because no such findings were made. No such guidelines were ever calculated and issued. So we are left with an arbitrary amount of $3,500 that was agreed to by the parties in this case back in February of 2011, and that was the amount that the family court seized upon and determined following trial. They agreed to it in February of 2011. That's what it's going to be going forward into perpetuity, ignoring our request for a modification, at least from and after the filing date of our motion in August of 2013. So we're stuck here now, several years later, with that amount, by the way, accruing each and every day against father in this case.
Anything further, Mr. Hartley, at this point?
No, I see that my rebuttal time has run out. I would just close, if I could, real briefly, Chief Justice, with a note back to Justice Nakayama, because I want to make it clear this is not a case about a father trying to subvert or not follow through with his obligations.
And so you just said that the $3,500 is now accruing since August of 2013, was it?
Correct.
So does that mean that the father is no longer paying any child support? That you're not paying the $1,500 either?
He is not paying anything pending
the not even 70. Appeal.
That is correct.
Not even what you thought you could pay under the guidelines?
That is correct. He has not. And that's
I paid nothing, but is paying his attorneys to be here.
No, he's not paying his attorneys either, Justice McKenna.
Okay, thank
you. But what he has paid, as I wanted to just make a final concluding remark, because it's clear in the record, again, because this is not a case where he's trying to avoid, he paid to date almost $400,000 during the course of 6.6 years, a child from birth to six and a half, 7 years old, almost $400,000.
How much did he make during that time period?
$400,000, $396,000.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant during his career.
Yeah, that was during his career in the NFL. It was only subsequent to his knee injury and retirement that we started on the modification request. And throughout the time from 2010 when he retired from the NFL, that's where the agreements to reduce the child support between the parties occurred.
Very well. Thank you very much to counsel for both of our parties. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Please rise. Honorable Supreme Court is now in recess.